Chapter 11, Betting the Presidency. The leak episode was just one offshoot of Bush's most consequential decision and the predominant issue in Washington as I assumed my new responsibilities as White House Press Secretary, the Iraq War. Many other aspects of the war would come into play over the remainder of Bush's first term, especially in the run-up to Election Day. Throughout the second half of 2003 and into 2004, with the Iraq occupation gradually becoming more controversial, Democrats saw an opening for attacking Bush's credibility, judgment, and competence. Had the president and his team exaggerated or distorted the intelligence on WMD to deliberately mislead the nation to war? How was the war in Iraq part of the war on terror when it had no connection to 9/11 and no relationship with Al-Qaeda? Why did Bush rush to war with no plan to win the peace? How did the administration miscalculate the strength of the insurgency so badly? Either Bush and his advisors had distorted the truth, in which case they were less than honest, or they had failed to recognize the truth in a rush to topple Saddam Hussein, in which case they were less than competent. In either case, the president appeared vulnerable. It was quite a change from the period right after the 2002 midterms, when Bush had been riding high in the opinion polls, and many experts foresaw an easy re-election bid. The Washington media were enlivened and energized by the prospect of a hotly contested political duel. With the president's credibility being questioned, an increasingly costly war, and an economic recovery yet to show any job creation, his popularity was beginning to sag, and the number of Americans who viewed him unfavorably was growing. This, in turn, affected the tenor of media coverage, a common occurrence in the era of the permanent campaign. When a president is up in the polls, he tends to be lionized in the media. When he is down or trending downward, he tends to be attacked. And in the case of George W. Bush, the media had more reason than usual to change its tune in harmony with public opinion. Having failed to be sufficiently skeptical and assertive in the lead-up to war, they would seek to remedy their shortcomings by challenging a now vulnerable president ever more aggressively. Bush and those of us on his team remained confident. We still boasted the bully pulpit of the White House, a formidable campaign machine headed by the famous and widely feared Karl Rove, an energized Republican base, and a national network of supporters among cable news commentators, newspaper pundits, and radio talk show hosts who could be counted on to defend the president. Every political calculation would be made within the context of the overall campaign strategy, which was calculated to ensure that national security, especially the war on terrorism, Bush's perceived strength, would remain at the core of the public debate. What's more, even as Bush's popularity sagged, the president and his political team recalled the old truth that you can't beat somebody with nobody. Bush was still a formidable somebody, while the Democrats had yet to settle on a nominee for 2004, a somebody with weaknesses and vulnerabilities of his own. As soon as the Democratic opponent was named, Karl Rove would direct the assault on him, drawing contrast in ways that would be favorable to the president and unfavorable to the challenger. As everyone knew, few, if any, in politics could do it better. The president would firmly stand his ground on Iraq. There would be no give on his part about the necessity of war. There would be no second-guessing the decision. There would be no doubting the eventual outcome. Changing the tone and ending the partisan warfare in Washington was no longer a consideration. As far as the spirited political competitor Bush was concerned, it was a time to stand firm and starkly clarify the choice facing the American people ahead of the coming election. His presidency was on the line. His legacy was at stake. He would bet it all on Iraq. In retrospect, this was the defining period for Bush's presidency, and it revealed much about him as a leader. As press secretary, I was participating regularly in most of the president's key meetings, policy deliberations, congressional outreach, cabinet meetings, and world leader visits. As a Texas loyalist, I was a trusted member of the president's senior-most team of advisors, frequently conferring with him and a select group of insiders that included Card, Rove, Rice, and Bartlett. World leader meetings at the White House usually included small delegations, equal in number, representing each side. The president's delegation would typically include the U.S. ambassador to the country in question, the national security advisor, the secretary of state, or one of his deputies or assistants, an NSC director for the region, the vice president's chief of staff, or national security point person, if not Cheney himself, and the press secretary. The Secretary of Defense would sometimes attend too. In the Oval, Bush and the foreign leader would sit in the light blue and gold striped chairs in front of the fireplace. Our delegation would sit to Bush's left, usually three on the couch, followed by two or three in chairs. The visiting delegation would be situated similarly on the other side of the room. Bush's strategic vision of changing the Middle East by establishing a free and democratic Iraq was one he emphasized in virtually every world leader meeting. These meetings, early in my tenure as press secretary, underscored, for me, that Bush's thinking on democratic transformation was the driving reason for our invasion of Iraq. It was a strategic mission much more grandiose than the one he emphasized publicly of eliminating a grave and gathering danger in Iraq. As the chances of uncovering WMD in Iraq dwindled, the dream of transforming the region became more and more prominent in the president's rhetoric and mine. The day before I officially assumed my duties as press secretary, I attended the president's meeting in the Oval with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. It started with a discussion about the president's recent trip to Africa and the unprecedented support the United States was offering that beleaguered continent, including HIV/AIDS relief, expanding trade, combating hunger, and supporting African-led peacekeeping efforts in areas of civil unrest. Then the conversation turned to Iraq, a topic fraught with tension. Before the invasion, Annan had urged Bush not to act without UN support, advice that Bush had rejected. The president viewed Annan as a weak leader who epitomized the ineffectual body he served. Ever the soft-spoken, low-key diplomat, Annan did not inspire confidence in the assertive, action-oriented, results-centered Bush. Nevertheless, their relationship was cordial and respectful. The president thanked Annan for sending the widely respected special representative, Sergio Vieira de Mello, to help in Iraq's transition. Bush and his foreign policy team felt it was important to have a UN presence in Baghdad. The more the United Nations and other countries were involved in Iraq, including countries that had opposed the original decision to go to war, the lighter the burden for the United States. Of course, this position was a bit of a contradiction, given the president's willingness to preemptively wage war without the explicit approval of the UN, though he viewed Security Council Resolution 1441 as providing him authority to do so. Hence, Bush's delicate encouragement for the UN in Iraq and his constant diplomatic niceties with Annan and other skeptical leaders, both in private and in public. Tragically, Vieira de Mello was killed on August 19, 2003, in a terrorist bombing that targeted the Canal Hotel in Baghdad, which had been used as the UN's local headquarters since 1991. 21 other staff members were killed at the same time. As a result, the UN dramatically reduced its involvement and presence in Baghdad for the immediate future. In speaking with Annan, Bush emphasized his view that a free, democratic Iraq was essential to peace in the Middle East. He acknowledged that the situation there was tough going, but asserted that the coalition was slowly getting the upper hand. He said he felt that Paul Bremer was doing a hell of a job in overseeing the early days of Iraq's fledgling democratic transition. Annan stressed the need to show that there was a light at the end of the tunnel to the American-run coalition provisional authority led by Bremer, and called the just-announced Iraqi Governing Council, a broadly represented body appointed by the CPA, a very positive step toward putting Iraq on the path toward sovereignty. The Bush themes would become increasingly familiar to me as I attended world leader meetings in my new role as press secretary. My first day in my new post, the president met with Prime Minister Vladimir Spidla of the Czech Republic. Bush began by thanking the prime minister for his strong support in the face of tough criticism on Iraq, and let him know his administration would not forget his strong leadership. This was typical of the president, I would learn. He tended to judge the character and strength of a world leader more favorably if he had supported the decision to invade Iraq. Spidla, like some other leaders who had lived under communist rule, shared Bush's passion for freedom and stood firmly with him on Iraq. Spidla said he believed what the United States was doing in Iraq would help bring peace and stability to the Middle East. "You make a very important point," Bush responded. "It's important to keep in mind the big picture, our vision. The action we took in Iraq will bring peace and stability. I truly believe a free and peaceful Iraq will have a long-term effect on the Middle East. Freedom is powerful.